Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Alongside me, of course, is rescuer of dogs, friend of Ulipo, taker of holidays, Thea Lenarduzzi.
You on holiday next week, is it, Stig?
I am, but yeah. I did say...
It's funny, because I'm not.
No. Are you going on holiday this summer?
No, I don't think I am.
You
hear?
What, are you undertaking much, now to appear on every podcast from now until autumn?
No, that doesn't. That's not what I said.
That is not an undertaking. How's Alf been in the heat?
Well, I have good news regarding Alf, actually. We took him to London.
Oh, dear.
At the weekend. We had to because my brother-in-law's 40th birthday and we couldn't miss it.
You couldn't leave
and
him.
Also, Phil, my brother-in-law, adores Alf. Almost as much as I do.
One of the great friendships.
A really great friendship.
Yeah.
Because they had to overcome some serious obstacles because Phil is a man and Alf not so good
man.
With the men.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we brought him to Finsbury Park.
I feel the same, actually.
Bearded men in particular, he's not that into.
I know exactly what he means.
So we had to take him to London and we had not remembered that it was Pride weekend.
Okay.
And also we had to go to Finsbury Park and Wireless Festival was on.
Oh.
So it was... insane. It was madness and Alf was so scared, but he overcame his fear. Alfonso the noble and brave, true to his name, and he overcame
and he exhibited no concerning
I wouldn't say that
examples of homophobia.
No, not that I noticed.
Oh, good. An enlightened dog.
Very enlightened.
Oh, that's good. Oh, hurrah. Maybe should you not get him a little friend?
Oh, God, no. He's so big, there's no room for any other dogs in our home.
Okay, well, that's good. I think we can all rest happily that Alf is doing well. Let's talk about the TLS. Here's your weekly encouragement.
Imagine that.
Yeah, exactly. To encourage to subscribe to us. If you live in the USA or Canada, go to podcast.the-tls.com. That's podcast.the-tls.com. If you live anywhere else, including the UK, then go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19. That's the-tls.co.uk/pod19. And you'll get 5 issues for just £5 or $5. Coming up this week, it's the centenary of the birth of Iris Murdoch, that novelist and philosopher who dominated the literary pages in the final decades of the 20th century. Where do we stand on her now? We have our literary editor, Michael the Dr. Keynes, on hand to steer us through our Murdoch special, alongside Frances Wilson, the great biographer and critic. Plus, this was the week that the US women's football team won the World Cup, so we thought we'd better canvass the opinion of another American athlete, the roller derby queen of academia, Devaney Loza, who rejoices in the name of Stone Cold Jane Austen. She'll be in the studio. I might even ask her what a roller derby is. It's folly, really, to await an anniversary before taking time to examine the work of a great artist, and yet we all do it anyway. Iris Murdoch was born this week 100 years ago, giving us, as Peter Conradi puts it in the TLS, an appropriate moment to ask about her own lasting influence. It's a considerable one, as our pages testify. Conradi quotes Margaret Drabble's praise that there is a magic about her observations that lights up the mundane world, alongside John Updike's recognition of her avid intellectual appetite. We might pause, though, and reframe a question we asked last week about Updike himself. Are the kids reading Iris Murdoch now? to which the answer may not be an unequivocal yes. When writers develop a critical industry around them, as Murdoch has, it may be a sign that their contemporary relevance is starting to wane. We've asked a bunch of literary folk what they think. I'll read a couple out here. Lindsay Duguid, the former fiction editor of the TLS, has got this brilliant kind of dismissal of Murdoch. She read her as a teenager in order to learn about life from a worldly sixth form mistress guiding her eager, innocent pupils towards a higher future. But then she notes, her old orange penguins are now faded and battered at the back of the bookshelf. To Jonathan Gibbs, Murdoch remains a conundrum, even on the question of her own relevance. Could anyone write novels like those now? Could a male novelist? Would they get away with it? Sophie Ratcliffe notes that she was called pretentious, a term often levelled at thinking women, but she remains grateful to Iris Murdoch for making me think. And then finally, the last word maybe goes to A.N. Wilson, who says this, I can scarcely believe my luck that I knew this visitant from Mount Olympus as a friend. For those of us who didn't know her personally, what should we make of her now? Michael Caines is here to tell us, as is the lovely Frances Wilson, who'll be spending the summer like me reading thousands of pages of non-fiction as we're both judges of the Bailey Gifford Prize. Michael, I know you love prizes.
I love prizes.
And we may not love prizes after we spent the summer reading all those books, Frances. But we're going to give it a go. We're not talking about that now. We're going to talk about Iris Murdoch. There's not a book about Iris Murdoch in our list, is there?
No.
Or is there? Maybe we should leave that as a surprise. First question then for you both. Where is Murdoch in the pantheon? Where does she stand? Who wants to go first? Frances, where would you put Iris Murdoch's reputation now?
I think that Iris Murdoch fails to interest younger readers because of her promiscuity. I think the new generation of puritanical readers cannot bear the sexual complications.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
And how sexual a novelist is she? I mean,
it's all sex. It's all sexual tangles and sexual entanglements and sexual chaos, and which is why I loved her as I was reading her. My reading of Iris Murdoch ties in with Lindsay Duguid's. I read her to understand what being an adult was about. So I read her as a rite of passage when I was leaving university and coming to London. I thought, oh, this is what being an adult's about. It's very, very, very complicated sexual relations. And everyone falling in love with everyone else at the same time and philosophising about it and talking about it and going inside each other's heads. And I think now that's just no longer palatable.
And really, I read a couple of people, including Patrick Gale in the paper, he talks about how she was kind of good at testifying to gay experience, that she put it all on the same level as heterosexual experience, which was quite rare for the time she was writing. Do you think that's an audience for her, Michael?
I think that's true. I think there's something else that comes out in Peter J. Conradi's contribution to this issue about her being ahead of her time in terms of simple things to us, technical things we might take for granted. Like, I don't think I even noticed this when I read it, but that there's an answering machine in a book that she started writing well before they became commercially available. What a bizarre thing to come up with.
And but it I plays think, a really important
It's a really
role.
Important answering machine, exactly, a vital answering machine. What a brilliant thing to come up with, just as in a kind of farcical way. But I think the fact that she's open to that, and that not only Peter Conradi, but Alan Hollinghurst and Patrick Gale noticed that, is part and parcel of her unremitting focus on ideas about love, about eros and agape. Those are the two things, her sort of phrases about this. And it's sort of her open-mindedness to that. So it's interesting that Peter Conradi recalls in this issue of the TLS that he asked her to help out, to contribute to a gay lib magazine in the 1970s, and she was ambivalent about it because she thought you shouldn't create a kind of secret society, was I think her phrase, but she wanted to support him, obviously.
And that's kind of a trend. That's kind of an issue now that people still debate. You know, this is last week was Pride, as Theo was saying, and that debate still goes on. How much should you be celebrating all equality and inclusiveness, and how much is it counterproductive to separate? And that's true of queer literature now. That debate still goes on, I think.
There's a really nice line in John Updike's appreciation of Murdoch when he says he's talking about what her novels did for him. And he says, it revealed that anyone could love anybody and frequently did. This news that we tend to love, that love is ambient and uncontrollable and comically cruelly protean, never grew stale for her. But it's this idea of we tend to love that it's sort of, that's the thing that makes the world go round in her novels, I suppose, that it's really quite, it seems quite irresistible, really.
Yes.
Is that not modern, though, Frances? You think that's not modern?
I don't think I even understand now what Iris Murdoch means by love. At the time, I thought I understood, and I thought this is something I haven't ever experienced, but I must love in a Murdochian way. And now when I read Iris Murdoch, I think, God, what? I mean, it's this belief in love, but what...
feeling or good... goodwill or something,
but then they're all terrible to each other. So she has this, she equates love with goodness, but they all behave just about as badly as you possibly could, and that's why the books are thrilling. If they were all good all the time, you wouldn't read them.
What sort of novels are they? If we had to try and classify them, someone who has never, I mean, I'm quite conscious that there's probably people listening to this who've read everything by Iris Murdoch. There's probably people who've never read anything at all. And what type of novel? I mean, she's kind of literary fiction. It's not really comic. Very seldom, is it? I mean, I couldn't quite.
It's comic. I think it's comic philosophy.
I also think
that if you've read one, you've read them all. There's very few people who have just read one Iris Murdoch. You get addicted because it's a very addictive universe.
Kay McLaughlin in the symposium says that she read all 26 and she's looking forward to starting again.
And they all blend into one.
Yeah.
Rather, don't they? I was thinking it was when I was looking back in preparation for talking to you today about Iris Murdoch, about my favourite novels, and it was really hard to distinguish one from the other. And it was, but in a good way, but it's also really hard to think of any standout characters, isn't it? There's no Maggie Verver or Jean Brodie.
Yeah, this is a criticism actually that one of the pieces makes about one of the experts in the field mistakes one character for another. Presumably, even for her, they just blend together. The one distinction that to me is, I think, might mean something is, okay, I think comedy, obviously very important, lots of farce, people basically almost falling out of
cover,
being caught in bed and all this kind of nonsense, but also that there's an element of an adventure to it, of romance in a more general sense, blended with a kind of realism about the way people live now. There's a nice phrase as well that Margaret Drabble has is quoted in the paper. There is a magic about Murdoch's observations that lights up the mundane world.
Yes.
And she can make a little drama out of anything.
The observations
really
are just sensational.
She can do that. It's really important. And that's one thing that keeps you reading.
Yeah.
But a distinction for me when it comes to the novels, which slightly helps me separate them out, is the ones that are predominantly first-person narration, often from a male protagonist's point of view, and the ones which are more like a soap opera, and she indiscriminately spreads her observations and her clever insights around between an enormous cast, and the plots go in 10 million directions.
That's a word that comes up again and again and again throughout the pieces that we have in the paper this week, is illumination, this idea of her shedding light. I wonder what's the kind of the relationship between her fiction and her philosophy, her work?
Well, are they philosophical novels or novelistic philosophy?
It's interesting, isn't it? She didn't want them, I suppose, to be seen as novels of ideas, did she? She didn't want to be called a philosophical novelist in that sense.
She said, about sailing, she would have written about sailing.
Exactly, it's her world, so she writes about her world, but that's not what she's not trying to do it as an extension of her philosophical writings. On the other hand, I think we touched on it, you know, Frances, when you mentioned the way she writes about love and, you know, what exactly is love in these books. I wonder if it's partly related to an idea that comes up quite early in her philosophical writing about the morality of attention. And
yes.
I think that's something that's a way in which her reputation is probably changing. Galen Strawson touches on this in this week's issue. The idea, I think, that philosophers are interested in the way she takes the legacy of Platonism and of Aristotle. And she's saying that attention is the absolute root of virtue, of how you're good in the world.
What does that mean, attention, like considering other people?
Exactly. So maybe we're so obviously self-involved and we tend to treat people according to that. So what we need to do is sort of break out beyond our own sort of worldview and see other people's and appreciate them as subjects like us, you know, people who want agency and freedom and all the rest of it. And so in a way, she's slightly tilting the balance there. You could put freedom first and say, we want to be free and do what we want to do, etc. But actually understanding other people and appreciating their needs is the more important thing.
That's quite interesting in the political context of all of this and Murdoch's own kind of political evolution, or I don't know whether you see it as an evolution or not, but her backwards and forwards between socialism, and she was an ardent socialist, she was a member of the Communist Party, and then she left, and I think towards the 70s she became a Thatcherite.
Yeah, there's a great swing to the right, isn't there? But it's interesting that she was she joins the Communist Party, which stopped her getting into the States when she wanted to go there in the 50s. And then she worked with UNRWA. So I think there's a sense in which she's living a kind of applied philosophy of being good. Mm. It's about helping other people. With UNRWA, I think she was in Central Europe for 2 years, helping people get basic supplies and passports and caring for others. And in a way, I sometimes think of her as being quite a selfish person, gadding around London and Oxford, sort of flirtations and things, and who knows. Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's the later period.
But she comes across very much in her life as someone who did everything she wanted to do. She seems as if she led the most magnificently self-gratifying life.
Absolutely.
I mean, there was no one that she didn't sleep with who she wanted to sleep with. Mm-hmm. And she put her own needs first all the time, which is why John Bailey got his own back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the way that he did.
Absolutely.
In this
magnificent way. He gets vilified sometimes, doesn't he? And you actually, seeing it from his point of view, it's fairly extraordinary to put up with.
Well, tell us about that, Francis. How has she been served by her biographers? Because you point to three people, one of whom is in the paper this week, her apprentice, Peter J. Conradi, her friend, another person, A.N. Wilson's in the paper as well, and her husband, John Bailey. How has she been served by those people?
Well, I think the afterlife of Iris Murdoch is every bit as interesting as one of the novels. And in fact, she might have written her own afterlife, because they're all kind of they're all dealing with her legacy in various ways and casting each other in various roles. I think that the villain of the piece, if you like, is the villain of the story is John Bailey.
Her husband.
Yes. The minute she died, kind of set himself up as a sex symbol.
unlikely.
Unlikely, but kind of cast himself as the hero in the story. And he very much hadn't been the hero at the time. And according to my sources, he behaved actually quite badly himself. But he obviously wanted, you know, he was a cuckold, and he wanted a cuckold's revenge. He started, when Iris was in the depths of her dementia, he started writing novels. I mean, he'd already written novels, and his novel, you have to remember, his novels failed. So she was fantastically successful. He was not successful. Mm. And meanwhile, she was sleeping with all his friends. Mm. And then
you can see why he might be a bit.
It's not. It would test a man.
I'm becoming a bit Team Bailey here.
And then Iris gets dementia, and he thinks, whoa, you know, for the first time ever, you know, she hasn't got exactly what she wants. For the first time ever, you know, he is kind of driving this car. And he then starts writing his own novels, and he's controlling the story. And meanwhile, he writes a trilogy of memoirs about her, where he's remembering not the kind of the dizzyingly dangerously attractive young woman she was, but the Teletubby watching old woman peeing her nappy,
and that became the film, which is Judy Dench plays.
Yes,
and because William Boyd says in the paper that her life interests him now more than her fiction, and I wonder if that's. I'm struck actually by lots of people throughout this. Every time they praise Iris Murdoch, it's qualified. There is, in all of this, there's this kind of tension. Lindsay Duguid, the battered bookshelves I no longer turn to. William Boyd saying, the life's more interesting than the fiction. I mean, in some ways, what worse can you say about a novelist than their life interests you more than their books do?
It's become embarrassing, I think, to say that you admire Murdoch. When I was in...
The writer.
Yes.
Or the person.
The writer. When I was in New York, I was talking to a young American novelist who told me he'd just read his first... He's 35, and he'd just read his first ever Murdoch novel, which I thought was the best, A Severed Head, and said it was the worst novel he'd ever read, and howled with laughter when I said, well, actually, it electrified me.
And why did he not like it, do you think?
He thought it was ridiculous. But there is a ridiculousness to her novels. I mean, so there's a seriousness and a ridiculous quality. And the ridiculous quality is the endless coincidence and the kind of crazy plots. But the sentences are so good and the thought is so strong. And they do hold together.
Absolutely.
But now people giggle a bit.
Yeah, and also I think this says something more generally about the way people read, that these people who offer this kind of qualified praise, or maybe say the life's more interesting, I can understand that. But that means they've been through this incredible encounter, and they have the luxury of being able to say that. And actually, that's true of many a novelist. I can't think they were all constantly true to one writer yes. all the time. This has had a profound effect on them, and they are changed people as a result. I think that's what some of them are actually saying.
Do we have to forgive her volubility? It strikes me that one of the knocks against her, and I remember reading a lot of Martin Amis reviews of her, and he's another one who kind of clearly admired Murdoch greatly.
He's wonderful on her.
But actually says everyone's called kind of the same name, and I can't work out who's exactly doing what to whom in the plots.
He says all the men are called Hillary or Julian, and all the women are called Julian or Hillary.
Exactly, yeah. And again, I'm not sure it makes... I've only read a couple of Murdoch, and I'm not tempted, actually, to read anymore. I respect them, but I don't love them. I wonder whether...
But which ones are those?
Well, I've read The Sea, when the Booker Prize. I've read a couple of others, but I can't vividly remember them now. But did she write too much? Is that another knock on her when we look back on it? That there, it seemed like in the 70s and 80s, was she doing a novel almost every 18 months?
Yes, she wrote way too much.
And this is partly what you were saying about self-gratification. She got to write what she wants. She wouldn't be edited either. So in a literary sense, she got to do what she wants.
Is that true, do you think, that she wasn't being edited?
That she, Carmen Khalil edited her at one stage and tried to shrink a novel, and she said, no, put everything back in.
And she did.
And that was that was her status at Chateau. It was Nora Smallwood ran it, and she said, Iris gets to say what she wants.
There's a piece I want to commission, but I don't know who would know enough to write it. We remember we were talking about this, how the problem of a successful author when they're too big to be edited. I reckon in the canon of literature, there must be so many great authors who do two or three really, really good books. And then for quite a considerable period of their time writing, they are effectively uneditable because they've got massive successes behind them. And they just go, no, I want that bit in, and no one is big enough to stop them.
It must have been the case with J.K. Rowling, wasn't it?
Mm. Would you think with the later Harry Potter books?
They just got too fast.
But that's true. Lots of people, I think, that you see, they sprawl and sprawl. But it just struck me that could you boil it down to two or three great books with Iris Murdoch, or are we saying that there is a... It's that we have to take the canon as a whole.
I think there are two or three, much more than two or three. I think there are half a dozen really great books. Mm. And Under the Net, her first book, is just devastating.
The Bell, everyone says you should start with
The Bell is sensational, yes.
Well, let's try and do this now, because people might be listening who've not read many. You've not read many, have you, Thea? So why don't we try and pick six?
Okay, A Word Child is my favourite.
Okay.
Under the Net, definitely. I love The Sea.
I like The Sea. I thought it was very... I enjoyed the sort of architectural... It was very well written, but it didn't move me. Was it supposed to be moving?
I don't think it's supposed to move you. I think it's supposed to amuse you. Yeah. It's another crazy one. It's this crazy plot of coincidences, where people wander in and out of each other's lives, having forgotten about each other for 60 years, and everyone's still in love with each other. As you know, you're still in love as an old man with the person you were in love with as a very young man.
But is that not rather a devastating criticism of a novelist, that the bit that a novel is, which is plotting at one level, you know, telling a story from A to B, hers were implausible? That seems like quite a thing to overcome.
But they're novels of ideas,
I
guess. And so you just do what she moves. She creates this her house of fiction, and she puts in her characters who all represent various ideas, and she moves them around. And because she's interested in love and what happens when people love, the implausible happens.
You can see how that can be used against her, though. I mean, Sophie Ratcliffe says she's known as pretentious because she's a thinking woman. Do you think is that a knock on her? Michael, do you think being pretentious?
Well, I think Sophie Ratcliffe's maybe equating that as a badge of honour, that she was called that and sort of throws it back in people's faces. Yeah. I don't really see that as a valid criticism at all. I mean, she writes about this quite narrow, small world in which virtually everyone is a civil servant or an artist or a friend of a civil servant. And I think there might be a housekeeper called Mitzi Ricardo. And that's as near as she got to a kind of real name. But on the other hand, I think even the plotting is distinctively hers. There is a particular kind of achievement in it. And she does a strange kind of movement from describing characters and mundane things, and there's intricate relationships. I just picked up the Nice and the Good, which I just think is one of the kind of archetypal 60s novels of many characters, many moving parts. And she introduces about six characters in three pages at one point. Yep. But then you move into a section where she gets deeper into the mind, and then suddenly you'll find yourself in a kind of there's a kind of mini adventure going on, and somebody's trapped in a cave or up a tower, and he's really and she just decides to do that and go down that, and you're just being drawn into this odd thing, and maybe it can be related to philosophical ideas, but it's kind of intriguing. I think also that's linked to the idea that people used to wait and go, I'm the next Iris is coming, next year is going to be a new one, and you get this kind of, you, so once you've read one, as you're saying, at the time you're ready and primed to take the next. Picking out six now is a bit different. I would probably leave the 80s and the 90s, take two from the 70s, yes, two from the 60s, two from the 50s. The 50s are very strong and shorter, aren't they, on the whole.
We have to say something about the Iris factor here, that she's known as Iris.
Oh, yeah.
Is okay. Any other...
Jane.
It's Jane.
Jane, yeah. Aunt Jane, yeah. I suppose. I tell you, you get it a bit with Emily. It's only ever female authors, and it's Emily, Emily Dickinson you get.
Or we have... I was thinking Iris and Boris. But we have these.
Oh no, Francis. This is terrible.
I know. These two things have never been.
He didn't.
Together.
This is a nightmare. She'd like it. She'd love Boris. Yeah. But also, I think this.
We can't rule it out, I don't think.
It's a kind of, I think it's a way, isn't it? Calling her Iris is a way of making her seem less pretentious and less intellectually threatening. Intimidating. Mm-hmm. And also, it's, I think it feeds into what we like about her, which is why Boris is called Boris. There's a kind of English eccentricity. Yeah. It's a class thing.
Yeah, I think that's in it. But I think as well, Murdochian is emerging as a kind of way of describing the type of writing, and possibly to philosophers, the type of thinking.
Yes.
So there's an alternative. Hooray.
Well, I wonder whether it's because this William Boyd issue that her life... Because if you get a film made about you, particularly starring Judi Dench, and so you become a character that's not far from a caricature. You know, if you say Iris Murdoch to a lot of people, they'll think of dementia.
Yes.
They won't think of novel writing.
That's a result, John Bailey.
Yeah. And that's not good, is it, really?
No.
Because people are being known for a later part of their life and also for a fictional treatment of it. And maybe that isn't, not fictional, but a filmic. I mean, I don't know how fictional the film is, but it will have elements that aren't true. Yes.
Oh, it's completely ridiculous. I mean, the idea that John Bailey was like Jim Broadbent, this kind of giant towering over Iris, when it's the other way around. That's point number one.
Does that bother you? I saw a film, Vita and Virginia, which we talked about, the new Virginia Woolf film. And in it, Virginia Woolf is this willowy six-footer, which I don't believe she was. And it's all...
Vita's tiny.
Vita's this tiny thing. It was the other way around. And some people, that really bothers, because if you're going to take the trouble to do this... I mean, I interviewed the director and I said, is it not a problem that these two people are so good-looking? It's Gemma Arterton, Elizabeth Debicki playing Vita and Virginia. I was like, these are so good-looking. Gemma Arterton. And I said, and I'm not being... It's not a sexist point. So I said, imagine if there was a film called Larkin and Brad Pitt... appears walking down the streets of Hull, unmade up, so it's Brad Pitt as created by nature. Do you think people would say, you know what, I like Larkin, but he did not look like Brad Pitt? I think it matters, don't you think, how these people get revealed
really
in film?
It's really important. It's really important, because you're kind of... Your ego depends very much on your appearance, because that's how people... respond to you. And so you can't just kind of... So your writing is really a response to what you look like, mm-hmm. or how much space you take up in a room. And to suddenly have the best looking person in the world representing you, you wouldn't have been a writer if you looked like that.
You can combine those points and think of Shakespeare in Love, where he's called Will. He's not a great writer, everyone, don't worry. His name's Will, it's perfectly safe. By the way, he's dashing.
He is dashing.
Did we mention that he's dashing?
He is dashing in that film. There's a whole new podcast to be had on that. We better stop talking about Iris Murdoch. But go on, one book everyone should go and read now. Give me one.
A Word Child.
Word Child, Michael.
Oh, this is terrible.
One.
The Italian Girl.
The Italian Girl. There we go. Two recommendations. Francis Wilson and Michael Caines, thank you very much indeed.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I defy you to name any other podcast that would segue from the life and work of Iris Murdoch to a joyous appreciation of the American women's football team, who won their second consecutive and fourth overall World Cup win this last weekend. In fact, it's not perhaps that wild a leap, because when Jonathan Gibbs celebrates Murdoch's ability to balance the serious and the silly, when Becca Rothfeld marvels at the humanity underlying her work, and when Anne Rowe points to how the novels illuminate for us the right thing to do, they might also have been talking about the US women's national team. In this week's TLS, Devaney Loser, Jane Austen scholar, and I mean this is the TLS, admires the Americans for their unparalleled ethos and skill within the game and without. They provide, she says, a brief opportunity to revel in America's better strengths. So might they be the ones holding the key to making America great again? Devaney Loser joins us in the studio now. Hello, Devaney.
So great to be here, Thea.
It's great to have you. I got the sense, Devaney, that you quite enjoyed this commission.
Oh my goodness. This was a dream. For this to be work and fun at the same
time.
When it comes together like that's a beautiful thing, right?
How big a deal is this in America than the World Cup? Because I was about to say to you when you came in, it got big here. So 12 million people watched it.
It got big quite suddenly here, though. It seems to have come out of nowhere.
Well, because we're just so desperate for any form of success. So when it looked like the women's football team was going to do well, I was like, yes, we all love women's football. But that's not quite the relationship America has with women's football.
I think when soccer. You say soccer.
Say soccer.
Go with
if
it.
If I occasionally slip into football, you'll like me more. I know but soccer is where I'm at. No, I think in the States, we associate soccer primarily with the women's team, which is wild, right? Or children who play, boys and girls who play. But no, this is a huge, huge deal, this team, and has gotten people incredibly riled up. Of course, the games are on live at very odd times for us, so that sort of adds to the excitement, I guess. You're watching sports at a time you might not usually used to.
What time are they on?
Well, it depends what time zone you're in, but it could be, you know, morning to noon.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and this final, in fact, when I was originally asking you, I forgot that you were actually in London at the time. And I was thinking, oh, you'll be in America, so the time difference means you'll be able to write this piece in the morning and blah, blah, blah. But no, you were in London, which is why we're lucky enough to have you. But you ended up in the Maple Leaf Pub in Covent Garden. How was that? What was the mood like?
So I wrote to the U.S. consulate and asked them where I should go, and they totally ignored my message. So that's not good. They must have had more important things to do.
I can't imagine.
But I also then just started crowdsourcing. And I have a friend who writes in the sports section for the New York Times, and he asked around his office. And the Maple Leaf came up there, and then it came up again on Facebook. And I thought, there's a reason why this is coming up.
Why? A Canadian pub is a...
I think there used to be a place called the Jet Lag that catered to
Americans. Oh, yeah, near the embassy somewhere.
Yes, and that's apparently closed. So this was the one people kept saying, listen, this is where the U.S. fans are flocking. And I'm from Minnesota, right there near the Canadian border. I feel like an honorary Canadian much of the time. So it felt like a good fit, and it was. It was a terrific place.
What was it like? Set the scene for us. What was it like?
Oh, it was absolutely packed, and I went very early, of course, right? Yeah. You know, I was on assignment, so I had my table all picked out, but they didn't have table service, so I had to leave my things, go to the bar, get my pint, and by the time I came back, there was another couple sort of saying, "Is this table taken? Is this table taken?" And ended up sharing it with them. So that's
nice.
The Miranda and Nathan in the piece. But it was like being in the stands. It was not unlike being in the stands. We weren't quite that packed, but it was really, really electric in there.
A feeling that really comes across in your piece, and it's kind of a joyousness or a sense of positivity, but also a really deadly seriousness to it all, which seems to fit with the force that animates the team as a whole.
When both of those things happen at once, isn't that just fabulous?
Yeah.
No, it certainly felt like that in the bar.
Why is it serious? Why is it serious?
I think it's serious because of the issues that are circulating behind.
Tell us what the issues are, because I think that's interesting.
Well, equal pay, obviously, as we talk about in the story. Gender and sexuality, both very key, very important. Five members of the team and the coach are out, lesbians, so this is an important thing. I think the news coverage looking at the players in France and the fact that they feel they don't have the same ability to express their sexual identities, their sexual preferences. This is not something we've had very long in the United States either. So I think it feels momentous. It feels different, both in terms of the identity, in terms of the social justice issues, in terms of the pay issues, all of these things.
And on the pay issues and the social justice issues, we should say that the team is currently bringing a lawsuit against the U.S. Soccer Federation.
Yes.
What are the ins and outs of that?
So at this moment, 3 months ago, they filed a discrimination lawsuit, sexual discrimination lawsuit, and right now they have agreed tentatively to mediation. So the next thing to see is where the conversation goes. It's not headed for a court of law at this point. It's headed for another possible outcome, and we'll see where it goes. But they are arguing that not only is the pay differential obscenely skewed, I think obscene is the right word. I think it's 38%. The women are, the estimate is 38% of what men are getting.
And they make more
soccer.
Money. Because interesting, in this country, the women's game is much smaller. The male game has been around for much longer, and therefore it makes a lot of money. So when arguments about equal pay, some people would say, well, hang on a second, the revenue that's driven by the men is very much considerably higher than the women. That is not true in America, is it? Women's soccer makes more money than men's soccer.
Yes, and this has apparently been true for a long time, although I think the numbers weren't necessarily as visible as they are now. There were 1 billion people watching this game worldwide. That's 1 in 8 people on the planet. And Nike, I think I saw this in the news today, Nike's reported that it sold more of these jerseys than, you know, record-setting number of jerseys in terms of its sales. So yes, it's commercially very successful.
So why does this inequality persist?
Well, that's a very good question. Yeah. I would say unfairness. Yeah. I mean, you know,
it's just the societal environment. I mean, does anyone throw any fig leaf argument? I mean, I can't think what an argument, because if you haven't even got an economic argument that's itself based on unfairness, what do you have even as a fig leaf?
I'm not the right person to speak to that, because it's just baffling to me.
Yeah.
I don't see how they could possibly have a leg to stand on here.
And how did the women in America become so good at playing soccer? What is it about over there that has facilitated this skill?
Yeah, so I talked in the piece about Title IX, this
piece
of legislation.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about this. Explain this.
Yeah, so 1972, the Education Acts, it was about offering equitable treatment in educational settings that received federal funding. And many people now in the States think it's a sports rule, because the way that it has been more visible, or maybe had more of a visible impact in many children's lives, is in terms of sports. So schools that were receiving federal funding needed to start offering opportunities for girls. And because American football rosters were so large, these teams for boys are huge. I mean, 50, 60 people on a team is not unusual for an American football team. There needed to be some way to get the girls' numbers up. And it was my colleague Victoria Jackson, as I mentioned in the piece, at ASU, at Arizona State University, who taught this to me. She said soccer was chosen because they could build up these large rosters to look closer, to look like parity with the boys' football team.
And it's a sport that football in this country, again, and a lot of places around the world, is a working class sport. It's played by kids in its origins kicking around a ball on a street. And that's true of Brazil. It's true of Italy, I suspect, in England.
Yeah.
That's not really true of women's football in America. It's a very middle class sport. The notion of a soccer mom has kind of crossed over the Atlantic in our minds. It's a sport that is it dominated by the privileged? Is that fair to say?
Yes, at least historically. And there aren't good statistics kept on this. You'd have to ask the social scientists for the most current ones. I don't have those quite as well at hand. But what I can say is that traditionally it was a suburban sport, so mostly white. And you can imagine the inner city schools didn't necessarily have resources that they needed to make equal.
Yeah.
You know, if you're dealing with no resources, you don't have to worry about numbers and equality.
Yeah.
So it was the suburban schools where there were more resources going to sport, where these girls' soccer teams really grew up in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s.
Yeah.
And the basic fact of it is it's an exceedingly expensive thing to get into on an individual level for the players, for the players' parents.
Yes, and I talked about this a little bit in the piece
That's
as
crazy,
well.
That's crazy, isn't it? Because a ball is,
exactly,
what, $10?
You're supposed to be able to do it anywhere, but no, you need... Well, you explain it.
Yeah, so it's primarily offered as a fall season sport. So if you want to play year-round, and anyone who's any good, of course, wants to play year-round, you need to join a club team. And a club team is going to have dues. It's going to require travel. These can go into the thousands of dollars.
And America being a big place, travel is not just getting on a bus for 5 minutes.
Right.
It can be proper travel.
And my sons aren't playing soccer, but I know parents whose kids still are, who, you know, to drive on the weekend 3 hours to a match is not unusual.
I want to ask you a bit more broadly about, are we living in a golden era in America of politicized sport? Because I think of basketball, where the stars are so powerful now, it feels they can really campaign for social justice. We see it a bit in American football, although it gets crushed a little, I would say, Colin Kaepernick. But it just feels that there is a mouthpiece. And in this country, there's a player called Raheem Sterling, who's a black footballer who is tackling institutionalized racism in the media and in football itself. And his voice is being heard, and he's using his popularity to campaign for social good. And in many ways, that's what Megan Rapinoe's doing and this team is doing. Do you think that's there's the stirrings of something here, the politicization of sport?
I absolutely hope so. I think my colleagues at ASU at the Global Sport Institute would say, hold on a minute, there's actually quite a long history of this and it hasn't changed things fast enough. But I hope that every new moment and the way that now sports are reaching, I mean, that billion person mark gives me hope.
Well, you've got to, I wonder if we might end this podcast on a uncharacteristically cheering.
We haven't mentioned Trump yet.
We haven't. Should we keep it that way? I think we all know where he stands in this whole thing. But since going to press with your piece, we've had a high profile endorsement. You were telling me this morning by email. Tell us about that.
Yes. So Miranda, I mentioned in the piece, asked me when
your drinking buddy.
My drinking buddy, exactly. I limited myself to one pint.
I knew I had to wait.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a one pint article, is it?
It's
a one pint article.
That's good to know.
So Miranda said to me, "Oh, I know someone from Arizona. I know." She said, "I know your senator, Kristen Sinema." And I said, "Well, that's amazing. I just got an email from her, a mass email, because I'm her constituent and I voted for her." And it was an important moment because I think with Miranda and Nathan, we were trying to talk around politics. This is kind of a thing happening now, I'm sure, here too, where you're not entirely sure.
Is that hard in America because it's become so polarized that maybe we shouldn't mention it?
I've experienced it as hard.
It's like Brexit in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And we'd used keywords that I had a feeling we were probably going to see eye to eye politically, diversity, and we'd been to the Pride Festival, and things that I
climate change.
Right. But Miranda told me that she actually does Ironman competitions with Senator Sinema, who is our first female senator from Arizona, the first openly bisexual senator in the Senate, and the first to declare no religion. So she's a really interesting woman.
Oh, my God.
I was happy, excited to vote for her. She won, not by a large margin, but the fact that she won it all in Arizona, which has traditionally been a more Republican-leaning state, at least in recent years, was very, very exciting. So on Facebook, Miranda posted this article, and I saw Kristen Sinema wrote in and said, "This makes me very happy." Right. So I love that our great senator, she said, "Arizona represents."
And social media finally doing some good.
Exactly.
Normally it's just this sewer of awfulness, and then it's that's great.
Ride this wave of euphoria to the end.
Yeah. Before we go, what's a roller derby?
Well,
derby.
I say derby. Again, this is like derby. Soccer football.
Yeah, okay.
Derby, derby.
Just
the London Roller Girls here would say derby. They would say
okay.
derby.
And it's like ice hockey, but on roller skates.
Not really.
I know, that's what I was going for. Go on.
It's 5-on-5.
Yeah.
And four of the skaters are blockers. One is the jammer. The jammer scores points.
Yeah.
The blockers are playing offense and defense at the same time.
How do you block someone?
With your full body.
Basically, there are legal blocking zones from your shoulder to your hip. You can't elbow. I mean, there are things that are penalties. And then anything from your hip to your knees, you can't use your head. There are rules. It's not like what you might remember from television.
Yeah, is that a tough sport, though?
Oh, it's a fabulous, fun sport. Everyone should go out and watch the London Roller Girls here. If they're here and wherever they are, they're thousands of teams now worldwide.
Well, they feature in your piece just at the very end where you say a skater calling herself Raw Heidi told me she discovered sport in her mid-20s and has since represented England twice in the Roller Derby World Cup.
She's called Raw Heidi.
Raw Heidi. And she says that growing up she was told, "Oh, you're a girl, you don't play sports."
Yeah.
So.
Your Roller Derby name is?
Stone Cold Jane Austen.
What a name that is. When I first learned that, when I just took over, because we had a really lovely piece for you about Jane Austen, and I learned that you were called Stone Cold Jane Austen, and my heart...
You can see now how happy he is.
It just makes me happy. What a name. Combining wrestling Jane Austen and roller derby. What more can you ask for?
I have a pretty good life.
Yeah. We're going to have to leave it there. That's positive. Well done. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Stone Cold Jane Austen, Michael, the Dr. Canes, and Francis Wilson. Make sure you get your hands on the TLS this week, especially if you have read a lot of Iris Murdoch, or actually none at all. There's lots of other good stuff too. Next week, we have a musical theme to the paper. So thankfully, indie pop star Lucy Dallas will be here instead of me. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.